This is not a musical podcast, and I am not a gospel singer. Yea, I do not even believe in the core narrative of the Christian faith any longer. And yet, every now and then, I am overwhelmed with a desire, with the need to sing a song of my youth, something I heard out there in Christianity land that is wedged into my consciousness and it comes up. And in this case, I am inspired to sing to you. I saw the light, I saw the light. No more darkness, no more night. Now I'm so happy, no darkness in sight. Praise the Lord, I saw the light. And you might say, Bart, why are you singing us that song? And I'm going to tell you, because a few days ago, I saw the solar eclipse in totality. And I want to emphasize in totality because, you know, I live in Cincinnati, Ohio, and all over the country, people were talking about this eclipse and the path it was taken. And I realized that it was going to pass, you know, the path of totality, as they say, where you're going to get a full solar eclipse, was less than 35 miles from my house. And yet, I wasn't making any special plans. People are flying all over the country to try to get to places. Hotel rooms are booked and everything. And I just didn't think it was that big a deal. I mean, yeah, I ordered some of those glasses. I got some of those glasses. Figured we'd go out in the backyard or I would leave my office for an hour and I put on the glasses and watched the eclipse. But just the day before it happened, I started to get cancellations. I had people booked for therapy on Monday, but my counseling clients were like, nope, we're going to watch the eclipse. We're going to watch the eclipse. I called my wife and I said, people are canceling on me. And she said, Bart, we got to go. She said, I just was talking to somebody. And what they said to me was, you want to talk about a gospel sounding sentence. She said, the difference between 99% and 100% when it comes to a solar eclipse, the difference between 99% and 100% is 100%. She said, when you watch it in 99%, you have to keep your glasses on the whole time and the sun becomes a little sliver of light in your glasses. But when you're in totality, for a couple of minutes, you're able to take off your glasses and you're able to see the corona of the sun fully, the sun itself is covered by the moon, but the corona, the light shining out all around it is brilliant and amazing and it's unlike anything you've ever seen. We got to go. And so we did. I canceled my one remaining client that afternoon and we grabbed up our granddaughter from nursery school and off we went to see the eclipse. And I have to tell you, it really was unbelievably striking. It was wonderful. I mean, we ended up in this park in the middle of the Miami Whitewater Forest in here in Ohio. And there were lots of other people there. And when that moment came and we all took off our glasses, people were just going, oh no, wow. And it really was one of those experiences that makes you think, ah, the universe, ah, the nature, ah, just life. It's just so, so amazing. And so I did. I saw the light. I saw the corona. And ever since then, it's been overcast here in Cincinnati. And if it had been overcast that day, we wouldn't have seen a doggone thing. And so I'm not only feel awestruck, but I also feel kind of lucky. And if I had known, I mean, it's one of those funny things, like the difference between 99% and 100% is 100%. That sounds like a gospel sermon. And if you're going to give your life to Jesus, don't give 99%, give 100%. But the other thing I want to say is like, if I had known then what I know now, I would have begged people to come with me. I would have invited people. I would have really laid it on thick and said, you got to see the thing. I didn't know what I didn't know what I would have missed. And if I had known, I would have not only been sure to be there myself, I would have brought more people. And doesn't that sound like a sermon too? You know, if only I had known. But once you know the truth, you have to call other people into the truth. And you know what? As funny as it sounds, like, I still feel that way about life. I feel that way about living for love. I feel that way about pursuing meaning. I feel that way about humanism, if you will. I mean, if that's what you want to call it, or you can call it whatever you want. But the idea that this life is a unique and marvelous opportunity, that human consciousness is a unique and marvelous opportunity, and that once you decide to make the most of it, the things you will experience in that effort are such that you will think to yourself, I wish I could convince more people to do this because it is so meaningful. It is so worthwhile. It is so wonderful. And so, yeah, I'm talking to this guy, Brian Schwimm. And I reached out, he sent me a book and he said, I will not do your podcast unless you read my book. Which people very rarely do that. I mean, it's kind of a fair thing to say. And I was so glad I did. And I'm so glad I got him on. Brian's a professor at the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco, which if that sounds like an offbeat school, when you listen to Brian, you're going to realize like he's a different guy. He teaches evolutionary cosmology to graduate students in philosophy and cosmology and consciousness programs there. He's put together PBS documentaries about the journey of the universe. And his latest book is called Cosmogenesis, An Unveiling of the Expanding Universe. And all I can tell you is, I read his book. I'm not going to summarize the conversation. I'm just going to say I got a lot out of it. I hope you get a lot out of it. I'm grateful to my friend Randy for suggesting Brian. Grateful to Brian for talking to me. Yeah, I'm grateful for the eclipse. Yeah, I'm grateful for a lot of stuff. I'm grateful for you for being part of this community. I hope you like this conversation, and I'll catch you on the other side. Brian, I'm very pleased to meet you. What's interesting is that you're one of the few people I've ever talked to on the show that sort of like, I will only talk to you if you have read my book. And after reading your book, I was like, okay, I sort of get it. Like it's a different book, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's not the way people mostly write either science books or biographies.
That's right. Yeah.
Or memoirs, I guess. It's like, it's a memoir, but it's weird. And then it's a science book, I guess, on some level, but that's weird too. And so I was like, okay, at first I was like, that's, how dare he? And then I was like, that kind of makes sense.
I didn't even know I was being bold.
Well, honestly, it ought to be kind of like understood, but
thanks for reading it. I mean, yeah, I appreciate it, Bart. Yeah.
How long did it take you to write it?
About 11 years.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm impossibly slow, but I was doing something different, and so it just took a while to get the hang of it.
I'm trying to figure out how to enter in. Like if I'm a listener, I'm trying to figure out like how to enter into this conversation if I haven't read your book. And so if somebody said to you like, when you wrote this book, like, or what are you trying to do with this book? Like, what are you trying to do here?
That would be a nice way for your listeners. So a good way to enter into our conversation, especially for listeners that know nothing about me, which may be the vast majority, is to say that I'm a cosmologist. So I have, from a young age, I have been just thrilled by stars and galaxies and then to learn the whole evolution of the universe. So I spent my entire life, my whole professional life has been studying and understanding the evolution of our universe over 14 billion years. And then at the end of all those years, I discovered that I had left something out myself. I never once talked about how the very fact of learning all this stuff changed me, you know, deeply. And so I wrote this as a way, you know, to understand who I am for sure. But my guess is this, Bart, that what I experienced will be experienced by many, many, many people as we begin to take in this radically new understanding of the universe. So I'm hoping to be of help to people that, I mean, we've, you know, a century ago, we didn't know if there were two galaxies in the universe. Now we know there are at least 2 trillion. Well, that is such a massive change of scale. And we're sort of, it's like we're waking up, having been in this dream of a very different universe, a static universe, maybe a young universe. And so trying to help people make sense of what it means to be in the midst of this colossal event, that's really what I'm about.
When you say this, we're just waking up to this new understanding. How new is it? Because, you know, I mean, I think you could go back to, you know, Copernicus.
Yeah.
But then there's, or Einstein, but then what I sensed when I was reading your story was that the moment that you sort of go like, this is when the big thing got figured out was these guys, I think it was at Princeton.
Yeah.
Who, the microwaves?
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
The moment at which we began to be able to sort of measure or capture or apprehend the light that is still emanating from the Big Bang?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, that would be for me personally, that discovery was a crossover point. But I would say for scientists in general that study the evolution of the universe, that was the crossover point. And what just to say briefly, what happened is that Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson, both working for Bell Labs, detected, to their great surprise, they detected the light coming from the birth of the universe. And it you know, it's just so just imagine, we've had, you know, over thousands of years of civilization, we've had all of these speculations about the nature of the universe. And I love speculation. A lot of these guesses were interesting, and some of them were accurate. But now, for the first time, humanity was physically interacting with the light from the beginning of time. Never happened before. And yes, you know, science is fallible, and yes, this theory will be adjusted, but it's really something. So I can't get over it. So just imagine, we've been human for 300,000 years. Every day of those 300,000 years, we've been showered with light from the beginning of time, but we didn't have the sensitivities yet. We didn't have the theoretical apparatus yet to understand that this light was here. We had no way of taking it in until we had gone through this long process of mathematical science, beginning with Pythagoras, you know, 2,500 years ago. That long sequence enabled human consciousness to deepen to the point where it could actually light up with these photons coming from the birth of the universe.
I mean, what's funny to me listening to you talk about that is you say, like, you know, we've only just gotten to this place where we can understand this. And I go, like, some of us have. And then there's me. Because
when I think about, like, my image of the Big Bang is so primitive, but like I sort of imagine like a pinprick and then in every direction, energy and light exploding out from it.
Yeah.
Like I have like an explosion, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And what I imagine is that, you know, as that energy and light goes out, like some of it forms into planets and gases and, you know, it's flying out in every direction and galaxies and all this stuff. And like, I know it's really like, I know I'm wrong. I know it's primitive, but like, as I do that, I sort of think to myself, okay, and I am made up of like, you know, gases of exploding stars and all this, like everything started in this one place.
Yeah.
And it all came out. And so then when you say to me like that there are photons, that there's light from that original explosion, if you will, that are being showered on me, I'm like, wait a second. If we're all flying away from that point at the same, you know, at the speed of light even, you know, shouldn't that light have outdistanced me by now? Like I'm a little heavier, you know, like how is it that there's any light from that hitting us here on Earth? And like, that's where I go, like, I am so crude in my understanding that I don't even understand what you mean when you say we're being showered by light from the beginning of time.
Yeah, I will explain. But you're, you know, first of all, your understanding is right. It's like, you have the whole sequence there. It's all there. Everything you're saying is correct. There's only one place where I would adjust. And that is when you start off and say, well, I can imagine, you know, the Big Bang is like this pinprick, you know, that expands out. Now, the difficulty with that is, where are you when you're imagining that? You see, we with Newtonian physics, we take this idea that we can observe the universe over there. You know, if the universe began as a pinprick, which is how we think about it, we can't be outside of it looking at the pinprick, because there's nothing outside of the pinprick. So the modification I would make to your own telling of the story is to realize that we are always inside the universe, always.
Right. So on some level, if I'm inside the universe and the universe is expanding, that we're all flying away from the pinprick, like we're all in this thing that's expanding out from the pinprick?
Okay. Every place in the early universe is at the very center of the explosion. That's difficult to imagine. And it's difficult to imagine is because, see, we've all been raised in Western civilization, and so we insist upon having a point of view that is outside and looking at something. It's this faith in objectivity. But we can't do that. So we do not have the scientific understanding of the absolute birth of the universe.
Right.
We can go back very, very close, but what happens is that we don't have any empirical data after a certain point, and we don't have the mathematical theory that can deal with the conditions there. So we have to imagine that when I say let's go back and be inside the original universe, imagine it being like the size of a walnut, you know? Mm-hmm. Now, there's no outside of the walnut. We're inside the walnut. Now imagine, okay, imagine there's a proton. There's a proton that is a billionth of an inch away from us.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, even though we start off a billionth of an inch away from the proton, we are expanding away from each other. The proton is expanding away from us. We from it. We are expanding away from each other at a speed that is many times more than the speed of light. So this isn't a violation of Einstein's special theory of relativity. This is because it's the universe that's expanding. Nothing is moving faster than the speed of light, the universe is opening up between every two points. So now here we are, Bart. We're at one little spot here, and there's a proton very, very close together. Now, try to imagine this. As the expansion takes place, we are moving away so rapidly that the light that leaves the proton is left behind.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. Right. Because we're going faster than the light.
Yes.
But then if we slow down.
And we are slowing down because of gravity.
Right.
And so that little photon that left the proton has been racing toward us for 14 billion years. And now it's just arrived.
Yeah. 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 We got a head start.
We got a head start.
Yeah. And we expanded away from it so fast. But it's catching up. And in a sense, like, I guess if the universe contracts, then on some level, everything's catching up to everything.
Yeah.
You know, right in the same way that everything ran away from everything. But that at some point, I guess, if it contracted, which that's going to happen, right?
Right now, we don't know. I mean, our theories, you know, they're only good for a certain extent. Right now, the general consensus is that the expansion will never cease. But even 20 years ago, the consensus was that it would turn around and collapse back. So right. In a certain sense, we have to be somewhat humble about the long-term predictions that we have. Yeah.
So for you, in your own life, that discovery, that awareness that there are photons that are, in a sense, catching up to us and raining down upon us.
Yes, yes.
That were there at the beginning. They're vestiges of that beginning. And so therefore, in a sense, we can study them or we can...
Yeah, we are. Yeah.
Yeah. And we can use that data to then extrapolate backwards to say, hey, maybe this is what was happening back then.
Exactly.
That was for you, this moment of... kind of epiphany of transformation.
It was one of them, definitely.
One of them, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess let me add one little point there, which I talk about in Cosmogenesis, but it was so interesting that it hit me at the beginning of my career as a professor. And it was because another professor was talking about the Greek myth about early light. And I thought, wow, from Hesiod, the poet Hesiod. And I thought, wow. So they have the Greeks organize their society around these myths, but they didn't take them as myths. No, they took them as like, this is what's happening. And I realized
I'm familiar with that process, by the way. I lived it for most of my early life.
Well, I mean, before I was doing the mathematics and all thrilled by this stuff and so forth, I wasn't thinking about the larger picture. And so here we had, the Greeks had their poetry and they gave the larger picture. And it started to dawn on me that the story that's coming out of science is going to become something like the organizing myth of our... What I think of as our a planetary civilization. So this won't be a story that's restricted to Greece. This is the scientists that are discovering and deepening our understanding come from all around the planet. This is a discovery that involves humanity as a whole, not one particular culture over here or over there. And so my basic, I guess, assertion here is that all around the planet, as this understanding spreads, we will see a major transformation of human consciousness. And I'm just sort of wondering what that is like.
Yeah. One of the people I've gotten to talk to on this show is Ursula Goodenough.
She's wonderful.
You know, she describes that story as the epic of evolution. You know, that there's this, and she sort of says, like, it's the one narrative that has the possibility of uniting people, you know, because it's, anyone can find it. It's available to everyone.
Right.
Because the data supports it. Yeah. And so, you know, it's interesting to hear that from you too, is this sense that you're like, yeah, the Greeks, like they talked about, like, I don't think it was the eternal light, or is that what it was?
Yeah,
the phrase from Hesiod?
Yeah.
You know, and you're like, well, golly, I'm studying this math and there's, you know, it turns out that I'm getting bombarded with eternal light. or if not eternal, at least 13 billion years old. Yeah. Right? Which is close. I guess moving forward, if we're not going to contract, it ultimately is eternal. Like, because those photons, you know, they'll just keep flowing.
I don't know what will happen a trillion years from now. We develop models, but to me, the amazing thing is just how magnificent the universe is. I don't know exactly how it started. No one does, or where it's going, but we have great insights into this, and that's really what I'm trying to celebrate.
Yeah. So you know, as you tell your story of sort of like, I'm a math guy, I'm a mathematical cosmologist.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's so many different people that influenced you. I think the most obvious one to me, I wasn't surprised when I stumbled upon a chapter in which you were like, I have to come to grips with my relationship with Carl Sagan. because Carl Sagan, for many people, is the best known cosmic storyteller,
for sure.
Right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And he was, you know, kind of like you, sort of saying like, it's just so marvelous, this story that I want to tell it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. No. And then if I can just say one thing about that, it's the awe and wonder that the universe evokes in us that I'm trying to celebrate. And I think, I know Sagan was as well. It's just at that level. And this goes, you mentioned Ursula's, you know, thought about this could work for all humans. You know, there will always be very, very diverse, different cultures, and that's powerful and important. But just to let the unbelievable nature of the universe into our minds, I really do think it will play a part in leading to a unified humanity. I mean, that's a faith statement. Yeah.
Right. That's right. And this is what I want to talk to you about on one level, because I spent the early part of my life as an evangelical Christian evangelist. And then I went through some changes and found myself at the University of Southern California as the humanist chaplain. And there I became an evangelist of a different sort.
Uh-huh.
And not an atheist evangelist. It wasn't like I was trying to find people that believed in supernatural gods and trying to disabuse them of that. I was trying to find secular students and win them over to this narrative is more wonderful than you think, and it has implications.
That's great.
Like if this is true, this epic of evolution, then it has implications for what does it mean to live a good life? What does it mean to make the most of this unbelievably precious opportunity of consciousness? Because you're part of the universe, but you're the part of the universe that's aware of the rest of it.
Yeah.
And that's a unique opportunity and unique privilege, might even be a unique responsibility for all I know.
Yeah. Bart, did you use the word narrative?
I did.
You were telling the narrative at USC?
Yeah.
So you were using those words too?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, I would use lots. I use, as I read your accounts of certain classes where you would like get lost in a reverie and you would just be talking about like, look at your hand. Like it's made up of energy and it's made up of matter from four stars that exploded, you know.
You were doing the same thing.
Right. But here's my question for you. You're very well aware that it is a small percentage of people who are exposed to those ideas of an expanding universe or of that we are all made of particulate matter that came from stars that exploded billions of years ago. Like, that this stuff doesn't motivate people the way Ursula thought it would. This isn't like a gospel that you can preach and they just fall in the aisles and they just come forward, you know, that it's a very rare thing.
Yeah.
And so what I'm wondering is like, as somebody who's thrilled by the narrative, thrilled by the understanding of where you came from and what you're a part of, like what's been your experience at trying to turn people on the way you're turned on?
Really important question. I mean, really important question. And it's so easy to get discouraged. Really, yeah.
Can I just take it one level deeper for you?
Yeah.
Because I have a lot of people that reach out to me in the aftermath of losing their Christian faith. And they're slipping towards nihilism. And they hear me, or they would hear someone like you, and they would say, I want to be turned on. I want that narrative to motivate and animate my life the way the Christian narrative used to.
Yeah.
And it's not doing it for me.
Yeah.
Like, why are you so turned on? How can I be turned? It's not just like these cold-hearted, mean people are like, I don't care what you're saying. It's people that are just going like, please, I need for this to touch me.
Yeah. Yeah. those are just great, great questions. Because they're coming out of your own, you know, life experience. To really take it in, actually a lot is required. You know, I've worked with people, like graduate students for the most part, right? But also I give public talks and retreats and things like that. And one of the things that I've noticed is that what a first step has to be a destruction or a dismantling of the inner system. And so the inner system, you know, people call it different words of one's personal metaphysics, right? The narrative that they've learned that enables them to hold the world together. A lot of it is can be considered as industrial consciousness. So that's the phrase I use. So all of us in the Western world or in industrial societies have been given a structure, a psychic structure for interpreting reality. That has to be weakened and even torn apart, because I'll give you a funny example coming from science. This captures it for me. The greatest cosmologist in terms of the public opinion is Stephen Hawking. I mean, his book sold millions of copies. I mean, Carl Sagan before him, but Stephen Hawking, who just recently died. And Stephen Hawking, when I get thrilled by what we're discovering about the universe, Stephen Hawking didn't get thrilled. And I'm going to tell you how he avoided it. So for instance, I celebrate the discovery of the expansion of the universe. It is unbelievable how elegant it is. And it was Stephen Hawking's calculations that showed if the expansion had been altered even by one part in a trillion, 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 the universe would have never evolved all this beauty. So that the universe is expanding at exactly the rate necessary for the unborn beauty to come forth. Now, I find that like astounding. That's about our universe. But Stephen Hawking and many mathematical cosmologists will do this. Stephen Hawking said he imagines an infinite number of universes. Not one of them has been detected. We even have theories that say they will never be detected, but we're happy to believe, I mean, Stephen Hawking was happy to believe in an infinite number of universes that we haven't detected, because then he could say the following: the fact that our universe is expanding at the right level is just mere chance. In all those other universes, the expansion rate is not right. You see, so Stephen Hawking and others, he begins with the assumption that there's nothing special about our universe. He even said, after, this is in his last book, that when you take into account these other universes, there's nothing marvelous about ours.
And you don't like that?
I don't like it only because it has no empirical evidence of another universe. And so in my thinking, he is, you know, the way in which when before Copernicus came along, the Ptolemaic model of the world had these epicycles. It was filled with complicated things. And every time there was a new discovery that called into question, they complicated the system to maintain.
Right.
Well, that's also what's happening. You see my point.
I do. And Brian, I got to tell you, I obviously I don't have a leg to stand on because I'm just a guy and I'm not a cosmologist, but I'm with Hawking. And I'll tell you why. I think he has no empirical evidence, but I think he's extrapolating from other forms of evolution that we see, where what happens is that lots of mutations happen and most of them don't make it. And the one that does make it, the one that in a sense is the fittest or best adapted, that's the one that goes through in life, once you get to life. And I think he might be sort of saying like, hey, it takes this fine calculate. It has to have this perfect rate of expansion for life and for beauty and matter and energy to form this way. And he goes like, what are the chances that it happened one time and it was perfect? Isn't it more likely that it happened a kajillion times and most of them didn't work? And you just happen to be part of the one that did. And like, I think the place where I would part company with Hawking is, I would go like, you're right. There's nothing special about the universe from outside, but from within, it's really special to me. Like if you're, you know, that it's that specialness or marvelousness is a subjective judgment. Like, so something might be absolutely predictable from the outside, but when you're in it, it feels different. And the best analogy I can give to this, Brian, is you and me having grandchildren. Because all my life, people are like, oh, grandchildren, they're amazing. Oh, it changed my life. It's the best thing that ever happened to me. And I'm like, shut up about your grandchildren. I don't want to see pictures of your grandchildren. I'm not interested in your grandchildren. It's not that big a deal. And then I had grandchildren, right? And I have to fight I'm so glad I'm still married to my wife, because she's the only other person in the universe that is interested to the degree that I am in every iota of information about my grandchildren. And you go like, Bart, do you think your grandchildren are the cutest grandchildren in the universe? And I go like, I do. I know it's probably not true. There are billions of kids, right? What are the chances that my three are objectively the most beautiful and brilliant kids in the universe? Like, vanishingly small. But I go like, but somebody's got to be. And I genuinely feel like mine are, you know, and so do you. And so does everybody. Yeah. And you go like, there's nothing, and somebody said to me, there's nothing special about your grandchildren. I would say, I understand, Stephen Hawking, that on a mathematical level, you're right. There's nothing marvelous or special about my grandchildren. But if you're in here with them, if they're your grandchildren,
yeah,
Yeah. Oh my gosh, they're the most beautiful and special thing in the universe. And that's how I feel about the universe. Like I go like, yeah, maybe there are a trillion universes that weren't wired up to produce consciousness. And this is just like, if you do it a trillion, infinite number of monkeys and an infinite number of typewriters, one of them will write Hamlet. And maybe we're just in the universe and on the planet and in the time frame where we got to be Hamlet, where we got to be the thing that got produced that's incredibly improbable, but absolutely predictable. And I go like, I don't care. From where I sit, a monkey writing Hamlet is a miracle.
Yeah, for sure.
And yeah. Why isn't that enough for you? Why is Hawking's thing so unpleasant to you?
Well, I would say if he had your orientation, right? It's mm-hmm. your orientation in the universe, which is the same or very similar to mine.
Yeah.
I don't know what to call it exactly, but it's something like a sacred dimension, or you use the word special, but there's something profoundly amazing about everything in our universe. It isn't just our grandchildren. So,
but it's to us because we're in it.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. But in the same way, the walruses are amazing, right? And fir trees are amazing, and because each of them relies upon the dynamics of the universe as a whole.
But now, finish the sentence, Brian. The walruses are amazing to who? To you. You're capable of amazement.
Yes.
That's the wonder of being a human being, of having consciousness, is that like we are the universe, like you said. I mean, I read that from you. Like you're like, you are the universe, but like you're this special case in the universe where you're aware of not only your own specialness, but you're aware of the specialness of the walrus. And of the photons. So I go like, I'm okay with that. I'm like, that's enough for me. It's special to me.
Yeah, I guess what I'm trying to say is that reflecting on your question.
Yeah, How do you turn other people on?
Yeah, how do you turn other people on? And so the point I'm trying to make is that there'd be a number of ways psychologically, in terms of one's consciousness, there are a number of ways to convince oneself that the universe the things of the universe are just here for our use. This would be an example. So that all of the trees and all of the oceans and all of the fish, they're just here. They're just things for us to do with as we wish. So that attitude, which is the modern industrial attitude.
Kind of materialism.
At least one form of materialism, yes. Yeah. That attitude has to somehow be deconstructed so that we can cherish this life we have on planet Earth, and that we can reinvent economics, reinvent agriculture so that we have a flourishing planet again. And I'm trying to connect how that move in consciousness is a deep one, but is necessary for us to actually move towards a planetary civilization. So it's true for me, yes, but how to awaken that same orientation? I'm not saying that this story of the universe is the only way at all. I mean, some people take psychedelics. Some people go into Zen meditation. This, I think, is yet another way to come to a kind of reverence for the entire Earth community.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, at one point, I remember reading that you said a lot of people think of the stars that exploded that provide the raw materials for our Earth and our bodies. And you say, like, it's very difficult for people to realize that, to accept that human consciousness emerges out of inanimate material. And you're like, no, 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 the stars know. And I was like, what do you mean the stars know? That there's an intention. Where's that? What do you mean by that?
Yeah. First of all, you brought up a number of really interesting questions. What does it mean to say the stars know, right? And is there intention? We can say we know the process by which a star functions. We have the equations. We have the theories. We know that. But there's another kind of knowledge, like how-to knowledge, practical knowledge. I know how to fix my bike. I know how to repair a flat tire, you know. Stars know how to create helium. I mean it in that sense. Some people are fantastic painters. I mean, like artists, you know. Mm-hmm. And they really don't know what they know. They could figure it out if they spend a lot of time and generate a theoretical, a theory about it. But their knowledge is intuitive. It's how to do something, how to make something. And that's what I mean. Simply that. Nothing more than that.
Okay. Yeah.
Earth knows how to create redwood trees because it did it.
Yeah. My son once was trying to point out to me that, you know, every cell, like a lot of the cells in my body, like they have functions, like to break down an enzyme in my stomach or something. And he's like, that cell is part of you, but it's also like its own thing. Like it's got its own intention. Like it's like, this is what I do. I break down enzymes, you know? And that we are made up of lots of different layers of things with intention. And you know, so the idea that like, so like, well, Bart, what do you intend to do today? And you're like, well, that's a complicated question. And I don't know, like, on some level, you're right. Like the earth knows how to produce redwood trees and redwood trees know how to produce bark. And I guess I wonder, like, is my intention or your intention any different, do you think, than those things? Or do you think that in the same way that those things just like unconsciously do what they do, that even our consciousness is something that we are unconsciously doing?
I don't think the intention is the same. I don't. And I don't think the knowledge is the same. So, we've arrived at this amazing ability to reflect back upon ourselves. And that's how we can come to, you know, to develop all of science and civilization. It's because of this amazing ability of self-awareness. So,
and in some ways, that's a natural process too, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, like completely. Even all our science and technology, you go like, well, you know, that's, you know, a beaver makes a dam and a human makes this.
Absolutely. At least that's how I think. Yeah.
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 So as you've gone through your teaching career, both teaching in classrooms to undergraduates and then graduate students, and also just running around giving lectures on cosmology.
Yeah.
In a sense, I meet people who are suffering. And so when you say to them, isn't it amazing that the universe has generated human consciousness? And they're like, actually, I'm in excruciating pain right now. Like, I'm not sure this is such a great thing.
What do you say?
I find myself thinking, it's hard because, you know, it's sort of like somebody who you're probably familiar with is the scientist Neil Shubin. And he's another person who's telling the story of how the universe came to be in a beautiful way. And I remember him sort of writing at the beginning, that the only question worth really answering in the universe is why not commit suicide? And there's a lot of pain and you know, what is it that makes this life worth the trouble? And so when somebody's in excruciating pain, I sometimes think like, there may be layers of of goodness or beauty or opportunity or possibility that you've taken for granted. And so you're weighing the pain on one scale, but you're not seeing the value on the other scale. And so sometimes it's a matter of not dismissing the pain or saying it's going to go away, but trying to amplify their understanding of what a privilege or what an opportunity consciousness is. And I think that that's where I sometimes think just know, like learning a little bit about where we come from or how it works or how the evolutionary process brought us to this point. I guess it's hard to concentrate when you're suffering.
Yeah.
But sometimes I think it's the only way out of suffering. Is to feel like you're part of something bigger.
Yeah.
And that the bigger thing is magnificent, even if the part that you are isn't doing very well.
Yeah. Right.
And I wondered, you know, as you look forward in your life to suffering, which, you know, not that you haven't had any, but more's on the way. you know, do you feel like this narrative, does it help you when you're suffering?
For me personally, it does. but that comes from a process that you just mentioned. So many important things in a life it involves suffering. And I sometimes, if I could just sort of suck out all of the suffering from my life, I would be diminished as a person. Now, I say that, you know, fully aware that when I am in deep pain, I don't see any reason for it whatsoever. And I don't want to be told that this will lead to something good. But that has been my experience.
And it doesn't always lead to something good.
No, suffering. Not always. No.
But in your moments of existential suffering or just practical suffering, does your cosmology, does your sense of being part of this unbelievable process and your science, you know, the idea that like you're one of the ones figuring stuff out, telling the story, does it lift you? Do you go like, all right, yeah, I'm suffering, but the universe is still marvelous? I mean, does it, you know, like think about like a person who goes like, I'm suffering, but like, but Jesus will reward me in heaven. And you're like, that's a way in which there's a narrative. I don't think it's a true narrative. I don't think there's any evidence for that narrative, but it's a narrative that sort of goes like, this suffering will be redeemed. Like there's like, or my character is being shaped so that I will be an angel and a perfect angel in a perfect world. And you're like, okay, I don't think that's true. And it's not compelling to me because I don't think it's true, but I understand how if you could buy it, it would make you feel better about your suffering. And I guess what I'm wondering is there a way that understanding the expanding universe and the marvel of evolution and the wonder of human consciousness, is there a way that we can remind ourselves of something that makes me feel like, okay, you know, I'm still hurting here, but there's some way in which it's redemptive.
This is just coming from my personal life. One of the things I find most amazing is that the humans and chimpanzees have 99% match at the DNA level. And I mean, yeah, that is a colossal discovery. 1%? I mean, so look at us. I mean, not that I want to celebrate humans as being more important than chimpanzees. I don't. But we've done so much, and we've spread around the planet. We've built 10,000 cities. We've gone to the moon, libraries, hospitals, you know. All of that was developed by humanity. And we didn't have the ability to do that. We separated 6 million years ago. from chimpanzees. At that moment, our minds were identical. There's just no difference. So, but during the last 6 million years, we have been evoking powers that were in potentiality. And one of the things I talk about in cosmogenesis is the ability for conscious recall. It's amazing. We found a way to evoke the power of conscious recall. Like, and you know, you mentioned about my book. I remember so much about my life and I can call it up, right? And there's no evidence that chimpanzees can. Their memory is tied to what's happening in the moment, episodic, it's called. So what are the powers that have been evoked? Well, we can name them, right? But here's another question. What are the ones that are going to be evoked? So I just had a recent bout with kidney stones. It was unbelievably painful. I mean, I wanted to start a new religion in honor of narcotics. I mean, it was horrible every second. But in the midst of it all, I felt my own this deepening concern for what was going on, you know, and these wars that we're in the midst of, and just the pain that they were experiencing. And that, so that one of the things that we are developing, humans are developing, is a comprehensive compassion. And it certainly, I was feeling it so deeply in the midst of the pain, you know, and the effects continue. I mean, it changed me. Not that I'm, you know, anything like as compassionate as I wish I were, but I felt like I was part of a process that was leading to an era sometime in the future when we feel so deeply for each other, we find it impossible to, you know, start a war.
Yeah, and that your suffering was a part of you being that part.
Completely.
Yeah. Yeah. So it took you all this time to write this book.
Yeah.
And have you written other books?
I have. Yeah.
Yeah. But they were easier?
Yeah.
Because they weren't about your story.
Yeah.
You know, I was thinking that I read an article years ago that said that reading fiction is a reliable way of cultivating empathy. That, you know, there's evidence to suggest that people that read fiction are more empathetic for having done so.
Yeah.
Because it gets you in the head of somebody.
Right.
That's right. Not you.
Yeah.
And you start to understand how somebody else feels. And I think, you know, that would be my recommendation of your book, is that I think if somebody was saying, I wish I could be turned on by just life itself, you know, without there needing to be some kind of supernatural, eternal reward, you know, like some, but I don't know how to do that. I don't think your book is a how-to.
Yeah.
But it is a story, like, this is how it happened to me.
Yeah.
And I think that it gave me an opportunity to feel with you as you were going through this journey. And I think that there is a real, like, I think that's a service, because some people are like, I don't know how to go down that path. And you're like, well, I can't explain it to you, but like, here, come along.
That's nice.
Come along with me. And like, at least, you know, and at least you'll get a feel for what it's like to get turned on, because I'm going to show you how I got turned on.
Yeah. Thanks. I love that.
It's a really good book for that. And that's why I was like, you know what? Maybe the best thing that we can do to help other people get turned on is to simply not just tell them, I'm so turned on. Isn't the universe great? Look at this story. Look at these photons. Look at this. But to say, like, it's dawning on me that, like, the reason this book appealed to me was because it was like, this is how I got turned on.
Yeah.
This is how I figured this stuff out. That I'm so excited about. And I think that that's something different. And maybe that's something that we do need to do more for each other, is to to use the words of my old culture, we need to share our testimony.
Interesting.
We need to tell people, like, this is what happened to me.
Yeah.
Not just this is what is true, but like, this is what happened to me. This is what it was like when I got in touch with these ideas.
Yeah. That's nice.
Yeah.
Share our testimony. That's nice.
And that's kind of what I think you did.
Yeah, I certainly did.
Yeah. And I want to thank you for it.
Thank you, Bart. I really appreciate that.
So if somebody wanted to learn something from you, how would they find you to learn it? Like, is there some online course that you're doing, or you're publishing a Substack or something? What are you doing?
Well, there's a Deep Time Network. Deep Time Network is an organization that puts together courses, and so I work with them.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's great meeting you.
Great meeting you, Bart. I really appreciate it. Bye-bye.
All right. So that was my conversation with Brian. And if you liked it, you know, you might want to go back. If you haven't, if you're new to the podcast, you might want to go back and listen to the Ursula Goodenough interview from a couple of years ago, because Ursula Goodenough's another one of those people that, in a sense, they're like, even though it's largely evidence-based, we still need to treat the epic story of evolution, the narrative of science, like a myth, because it can function like a myth in that it can be something that's easily, if we think of it as a myth, then we share it as if it's our own story and the story of and a story that explains why we do things the way we do, or why we care about what we care about, and that it can be useful that way. So I'm grateful to my friend Randy, who's the guy who said, hey, you got to have Brian on the show. I'm grateful to Brian for coming. I'm grateful to you for listening. I'm grateful for the eclipse. I'm grateful for a lot of stuff. And I'm not objective about any of it. And neither are you. And that's why we are human. Talking about humanity on Humanize Me.
Additional content can be found at patreon.com/humanizeme, including bonus episodes, video newsletters, the Campolo sessions featuring conversations with Tony Campolo, and show merch. Our patrons make the show happen. Without you, it would be impossible. Bart's website can be found at bartcampolo.org.
You could be larger than life.